Hello, and welcome to another D-Rays Bay podcast special. My name is Danny Russell. I am the managing editor of D-Rays Bay, and today I am joined by...
Darby Robinson.
And Adam Berry, the new slash returning beat writer for the Rays for MLB.com/RaysBaseball.com. You will be reading his information constantly from here until eternity on the Rays website. That's a really weird thing to say. I shouldn't have said that. From here to eternity?
Time and space will fold, and the only constant after the heat death of the sun is Adam Berry on the beat. This is needed.
Listen, it's a good prospect list. That's the point. He wrote up the Rays top 30 prospects, and we go deep on this list.
It's, yeah, if you like prospects, if you want to hear about the number one system in all of baseball, this is the podcast for you. We will kind of cover everybody on that top 30 list and off of the top 30 list with some nice surprising names, and talk about whose stock are we buying, who diamond hands rocket ships to the moon, as well as who we might see in 2021 for the Rays.
And we also start the conversation talking about a very special Rays prospect. Today was the first day that Brent Honeywell Jr. returned to the baseball mound. It was Honey Day in the Rays blogosphere.
Praise be. Been waiting 3 long years for Honey Day to arrive.
I mean, 4, really?
Yeah.
His last pitch was in 2017.
Already now, with that one inning, maybe one of the best stories of the spring. Probably the best story of the spring. It's the best story of the spring.
It's the story of the spring. All
of baseball. It's the only story you need to hear. All of baseball. So it's just Honey.
Anyway, but Honeywell, this is amazing. Fantastic outing. Yes, it was great. And so we start out talking about Honey Day, and then we get into kind of the Rays generally, and then very deep into the Rays prospect list. I hope you enjoy. So today was a really big day in the Rays world. It was Honey Day. A lot of people are very emotionally invested in Brent Honeywell Jr. Through his injury history dating back to 2017, 4 separate elbow surgeries, and also just being this gregarious, wonderful personality. But it's fans, it's players, it's staff. Clearly everyone really, really cares about the guy. And today was his first day on the mound. What were your thoughts on his outing?
Yeah, honestly, I think the most important thing is just that he was out there, period. I mean, 1,281 days since the last time he pitched in a game against a team wearing a different uniform, and that was in the AAA National Championship game. If you want to go through the lineup that the Durham Bulls ran out then, it's a real, like, remember some Rays type of lineup.
Oh, no. No, do you have it? Do you have it in front of you?
I don't have it right in front of me.
If you find it, keep talking about it.
I'll pull it up as we're talking here, but... I think the thing that stood out to me is just the enthusiasm everybody else had for Honeywell getting back on the mound. I mean, that meant something to a lot of people in the organization, in part because of, I think, like you said, what Honeywell means to all of them. He has been, I mean, Tyler Glasnow, when we talked to him before the game, said like Honeywell was like a leader in the postseason bubble last year, which seems crazy for a guy who hasn't pitched in a big league game, you know, much less in a game period in nearly, you know, 3.5 years. But he is that invested in his teammates. He's that passionate. He's that much of a baseball junkie that I think it really just, he is kind of in a lot of ways an emotional center of the clubhouse in a way that like Kevin Kiermaier and Willie Adames are. And I think that's reflected every time he pitches, whether it's in a backfield game or, you know, the way that he did today, everybody's there. All the players are out there in the stands. Like everybody's watching. Archer joked that like Chaim Bloom was there, and it's like, well, he was there because the Red Sox, but yes, he was also there. I'm sure he was happy to see Brent Honeywell too. I think the emotional impact of it is really the most important thing, and what it means for Honeywell that he's not a rehab guy anymore. He's a healthy pitcher who's kind of on the progression toward impacting the Rays at some point. Kevin Cash said he's going to do so in the not too distant future, which says a lot about the guy considering, you know, how little he's pitched recently. And the stuff is back to me. I mean, we can talk about it when we get into the prospect list, but one of the reasons that he kind of fell down the list is just uncertainty over whether this stuff is going to come all the way back, especially the fastball. But he hit 95 on his first pitch today. Like that's pretty impressive. That says a lot. And, you know, the changeup's still there. It's nasty. The slider, I think, is a weapon now in maybe a way that it wasn't before. You know, it's a really interesting pitcher. And as long as he stays, he's one of those guys that, like, as long as he's healthy and as long as he's able to take the mound, you can kind of count on him. I don't think anybody's done a discount Brett Honeywell simply because of how hard he works and how much they believe in him.
I didn't think we were going to see the screw change. to be honest, or whatever it's supposed to be called. The screw, everyone just wants to call it a screwball because it is the most fun. But if I just had four elbow surgeries, I'm not throwing that pitch.
Right. Well, I think it is more just the changeup now. It's like the changeup with kind of that screwball action. And everybody I talked to said, like, that's his best pitch. Like, the screwball is really fun to talk about. Like you said, it's exactly that. It's neat. It's kind of a novelty. But, like, that changeup is nasty. Like, that is a plus changeup. And, it gets swing and miss all the time. Like, it was crazy on the backfield. Somebody said, like, every single one he threw in one live BP was swung and missed on. Like, that's a really nasty pitch. I pulled up that lineup, by the way, if you want me to do.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Hit
it. Oh, yeah.
All right. Starting in center field, Johnny Field. Second base, Kian Wong. Willie Adames at shortstop, maybe you've heard of him. Mm-hmm. Jake Bowers at first base. Patrick Leonard in left field. Shane Peterson in DH. Daniel Robertson at third base. Justin Williams in right field. Justin O'Connor behind the plate.
Wow. There are some names. There are some names on there. I think I just added a few more gray hairs, like feeling that was just like a few years ago, and that feels like forever ago.
Why did Justin O'Connor just hurt me? Bustin' Justin. I haven't thought about him in years. That's why.
You know what's funny is there are some guys, like a lot of guys in that roster who were drafted or like prospects in the organization when I covered the team before I left to go cover the Pirates 6 years ago. It's like really a big, like I said, a real remember some Rays lineup. Slightly more familiar names. Ryan Yarbrough started that game and Diego Castillo got the save. So that's fun.
Mm. Wow. That brings it together. And so 6 years ago, so you are probably the best equipped person to answer a very important question for me. Do Pirates fans just hate Rays people now?
You know what? You cannot mention Tyler Glasnow or Austin Meadows or Shane Baz or now Chris Archer without just like absolute fire and brimstone in your mentions on Twitter. Like it's crazy to me that like when Tyler Glasnow was named the Rays opening day starter and tweeted out there, and obviously with my history of having covered the team, I still have a lot of followers from Pittsburgh, and it's just like it's tough to see because it's it's the one that got away. It's like he's so good now, or he's still like the sky's the limit for the guy, and then they just have nothing to show for it in return because Archer obviously didn't pan out and then ultimately came back to the Rays. So it's pretty much the worst case scenario when you talk about that trade. And I think I've said elsewhere before is that like you can talk about the trade and like what it means for the organization, but like pretty much everybody who was involved in that deal is no longer working there, which probably says a lot about the way that trade went down and what it meant.
I like to think about rivalries and how they exist and how they function. You have the long history of the Rays and their rivals. And I would say early on, it was the Yankees were number one, and then it kind of moved to the Red Sox. But then these natural rivalries kind of come up, and Twitter is a breeding ground for it. You can kind of tell the animosity. And I just feel like the Pirates is like the next one. Like there's going to be a Rays Pirates rivalry forever. But maybe it's just seasonal and maybe they all come in waves. There was some kind of like Oakland fake rivalry happening because of the playoffs in 2019. And then that dissipated, right?
Right.
I just wonder if like once the Pirates get good, I feel like the Rays will be the white whale or like that one team they want to be able to show up.
I think that would certainly be a team that like they would like to see at some point when they get good. And don't get me wrong, like I think there's a lot of smart people in that front office now, and like they're doing things the right way. They've learned a lot of lessons, I think, from the way that the Rays do business. And I'm sure that at some point they would like to make a trade and say like, "Haha, we've done our Archer trade."
Hudson. Wasn't that the Pirates
with Corey Dickerson,
Gray,
Dickerson, Gray, Hudson, and Gray,
who homered today. And looks like a pretty interesting minor league player. Like a big kind of randomly power hitting middle infielder who's probably a better shortstop now than he was when he got traded. So that's actually a funny story. I was covering the Pirates obviously when that trade went down, and it's one of those days that I think it was like their golf tournament day in spring training, the last workout day. Trade goes down. We hear Corey Dickerson, Daniel Hudson's on the way out, Tristan Gray. So we all go back into the clubhouse, back when we could go into the clubhouse, and looking around, does anybody know Tristan Gray might look like? And see a guy walking by us with his bag in his hand and turns around to some other player and goes, "I just got traded." And we say, "Hey, that's Tristan Gray." And here he is now. Yeah.
I had a similar experience with Brandon Lau the day he was promoted. So I walk into the clubhouse And I'm looking around and I'm looking for Brandon Lau. And I cognitively know what he looks like, but I always see him with a hat or a helmet. So seeing him without something on his head would be surprising. And he was listed as 6'185" on the, like, on RaysBaseball.com, like on the roster. That's how he was listed when he was promoted. And I'm looking around and I don't see him. And so I walk over to a guy that I assume is a clubby.
Oh, no.
Danny. And I didn't say anything. But he just looks over and he's like, I'm so excited to be here. And I was like, this is Brandon Lau.
Oh, wow. And that's tough, yeah.
I was like, I'm taller than you. This doesn't make sense, but good luck, buddy. And then it turns out
best power hitter on the Rays. And yeah.
You wrote that article recently, Darby.
I did.
I was at the Blue Jays game when him and Austin Meadows were going to the 500 level. It does not make sense to me.
He had a pretty funny joke this morning when we talked to him, actually, kind of about Honeywell. He was saying, you know, I think Mark Topkin asked him about, like, how do you feel about the ball being dead? And as a hitter, obviously you don't like it. He says, absolutely not. And he says, I'm a singles hitter now, so I better work on my speed. But somehow I think he'll be just fine hitting for power still.
Yeah.
Well, he's got the secret weapon. His hitting coach is his wife. And so he always has his hitting coach right next to him telling him what he's doing wrong.
That's right.
Yeah.
Toronto. Toronto's going to be playing in Florida. Has that been a topic of conversation?
Not that much, honestly. I think it's just spring training, everything's so insular. You know, like, you're focused on the story of the day, what the team's got going on, the players that you are able to talk to. And this spring's so different, obviously, with not being in the clubhouse. There's less kind of shooting the breeze conversations like that might come up. I have talked to some players who have talked about the possibility of, like, the Rays Blue Jays road trip, where you just come to Tampa and kind of set up shop for a week or so in Pinellas County. But yeah, I mean, it's kind of hard to tell. And also just the uncertainty of when they might be able to move back. Like, is this a month? Is it 2 months? It's hard to tell. So spring training is so one day at a time, get on to the next one, you know, focus on opening day. And then once opening day arrives, like, kind of your whole world opens up again. Hey, the regular season, like, let's talk about that. But still a couple more days to go until we can worry about that.
Yeah. I feel like a bad baseball fan, because I personally just hate spring training, because people will be like, oh, such and such person homered, it's now 6-4. Okay, homered off of who?
right. And, like,
why does the score matter?
I think it's really interesting to me, and I kind of appreciate that Kevin Cash has even been pretty open about it, like, that their organizational focus is just, like, don't come in and worry about what you're doing in spring training. Like, we're not evaluating you off your stats and whether or not you had two strikeouts or one strikeout today, or if you had a home run or a double. Like, I think it speaks a lot to the Rays' confidence in their own evaluations of players, that, like, they know what they have coming in. Certainly, you know, your eyes can be opened and players can improve over time, especially in spring training with all the hands-on instruction. But, like, don't get caught up in whether, you know, they won or lost or who did what on a given day. Like, you never, ever remember what happened in spring training by the middle of April, ever. Like, never. So, like, why are we worried about it now, other than the fact that it is the baseball that happens in front of you? And, like, there are neat stories that pop up, like Brent Honeywell. Like, that matters, because it's significant. It's a story. Like, I think Austin Meadows went 0-for-5 today. Like, who cares? Like, it doesn't matter. Austin Meadows is healthy. That is the part of this that matters. And Austin Meadows, when he's healthy, is a good baseball player. So, like, I'm not going to get caught up when a guy's spring training batting average, you know, it's however many at bats split up over however many days, not playing every day consistently, not doing pregame scouting reports. Like, I get it. It's the baseball we have in front of us. It's fun. It's good to enjoy. There are certainly moments and storylines that matter, but, like, I cannot emphasize enough, you should never get caught up with the spring training stats.
For sure. Now, you mentioned one of the things is that 2021 is going to be very different, similar to 2020 in a lot of ways, but also a little different. The Rays, through the offseason, kind of definitely made some big changes, but have been really focused on the idea of multiple pitchers, and seemingly focused on the idea of pitcher injury and pitcher health, and getting people ramped up for 162 game season. So can you talk a little bit about that strategy? Is this like a big strategy that you think might be other teams thinking of this, or is this something that just the way the market fell to them the way their money situation is, that this is just they had to do?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think when they traded Snell, you kind of heard from Eric Neander that like it's going to be a transitional year for the rotation, which it is, because you're going to see Shane McClanahan at some point. You're going to see Luis Patino at some point, obviously as a result of that trade. Maybe Brendan McKay getting back in the mix at some point. Joe Ryan probably later in the year. The thing is, though, when you're in the Rays position and you are looking to contend year in and year out, coming off of a World Series appearance, you cannot count on that bridge arriving in April. You can't count on stepping off onto that bridge. So what they've done is they brought in essentially a lot of veteran pitchers to get them there. You know, Chris Archer, Rich Hill, Michael Wacha, who's looked really good this spring. Not worried about the stats, but like the stuff has looked good. Colin McHugh, just arms to help them bridge the gap to those guys, who can also just provide the innings that they need, because, you know, you're not going to count on Shane McClanahan to throw 180 innings, or Luis Patino to throw 180 innings, or even if Charlie Morton or Blake Snell had come back, you weren't going to get 160, 180 innings out of those guys coming off of last year. Just the jump in workloads wouldn't have worked. So what they have done, and I think is really interesting, is essentially just thrown depth at the problem. And, you know, if it works out where you get Rich Hill's 80 best innings, fine. Like Rich Hill's 80 best innings are probably going to be really good. And that's all you should need if all of your depth pans out. You know, maybe you get 120 innings from Michael Wacha, fine. Then you're still going to have a guy to call up after that and hopefully fill the gap the rest of the way. And you know what, if some of these guys click and they are able to work more, great. You know, if Shane McClanahan shows he's ready in May, great. Like that's a good problem to have. So I think what they've done is a really interesting combination of bridging their own gap that they need to do in the rotation, plus kind of trying to attack this industry-wide concern about pitcher workloads. I'm curious to see how it works out. Like, you can't predict injuries. I think they were a little bit spooked by the injuries they encountered last season and just kind of weren't expecting that, and they were trying to over-prepare rather than being caught shorthanded if something or a similar situation does arrive this year. So it's interesting. You know, it's funny for all the talk that we had about, like, you know, maybe it's going to be a crazy 8-to-10 man rotation, like in February. Like, it's going to be a pretty traditional 5-man rotation to start the season. I just don't know where it goes from there as far as when the guys come up and how they fill those innings.
Well, I remember in February, gosh, it might have been your first week on the Rays beat, but you were on Raise the Roofs podcast, and you said something that stuck with me, and it was that either this strategy will be 10 guys all average 100 innings, or it'll be like 10 guys throw exactly 100 innings. It's one of these two things is going to happen. Right. This group of pitchers, either like a couple will succeed and then they all average 100, or some of them will just like share the load all the way across.
Right, because I think
I've been fascinated by that idea the whole way through. Ever since you said that, I was like, oh, well which one will it be?
Right, and it could be anything. Like if Tyler Glasnow comes out and shows that he has the health to throw 140, great. If he can throw 160, great. But you might not get 60 out of Rich Hill, based on his injury history. Right. And maybe you don't want to get more than that, given his age and all the concerns you have there. So, you know, are they going to divide it up evenly? Or are they going to, you know, go in shifts? Like there's so much unknown. That you
I
really
just wonder if
it
becomes a thing, because the last time the Rays felt pushed into a corner and instead of going to the free agent market to fix it in big spender ways, they just said, forget it. We'll put some relievers out there first and then we'll roll with Johnny Chirinos and Ryan Yarbrough, and they can just pitch out of relief because they're not ready for the show yet to take that on all the way. And so we'll do something in between. And so I think there's a non-zero chance we get that if the Rays are succeeding and the pitchers are averaging like a consistent workload across 10 guys, mm-hmm. then I think it might become like the next thing, when really it's probably just the Rays going, we can't do anything else.
Right. And it's so unique to this year as well. But I would agree. I mean, the tough part of that is probably going to be finding veterans who would come in and want to do that. Like, they've been fortunate with this group that, like, Michael Wacha is just like such a high character, like plus teammate type of guy that, like you said, fine, I'll do whatever. Obviously, you know, Chris Archer is the same way. Plus, he's coming off of injury concerns of his own, needs to kind of reestablish his value. Colin McHugh is such a versatile veteran, good teammate type of guy. Like Rich Hill is just all about winning a championship. Like they have found a really interesting mix of people to do this as well, not just pitchers. So like they are willing to say, sure, throw an opener in front of me, I'll go out and do it. Whereas you might have a tough time talking, you know, whether it's free agents or even some of your own guys into that in more normal circumstances. So it's probably a combination of both, but if it works, I do think it'll be a pretty interesting conversation to be had this offseason, next offseason.
Before we get into prospects, we already had a conversation about how spring training doesn't matter, but are there any players who are standing out for you right now? I mean, you mentioned the quality of Waka, so that's kind of where my brain's going. Who else has really stood out to you?
The health of Austin Meadows is a big one. Like I said, when he's healthy, he's going to be good, and he's healthy. That matters pretty much more than anything else. He stood out. Manuel Margot has looked really good. There was a lot of talk early in camp about how much more comfortable he is. And like, he had such a terrible year personally off the field that like, it's amazing that the guy contributed even the way that he did, especially in the postseason, as good as he was, just having to play through all that and deal with everything. But then there's been talk that he's more comfortable, that he's a little bit more receptive to some of the messages he's getting from the hitting coaches. And I think it's really showing. He's looked very good. Trying to think off the top of my head where Michael Waka definitely mentioned. Mike Brosseau has looked really good. He's a guy who kind of wants to prove himself as an everyday type of player, which those opportunities likely won't be there, just given the way that the Rays work. But
you're just saying that because you're like doppelgangers.
That's right. Noted lookalike.
What's Brosseau doing in the press box?
Or what am I doing on the field?
It's just that Rays versatility.
That's right. I can do everything, man.
Just a utility player.
He's definitely looked good though. And I think he's going to get a chance to show it with G-Man Choi out to start the season. Sure. Another Yoshi Tsutsugo has looked pretty good just physically coming in. I know again, the spring training stats don't jump off the page, but he's another one of those guys that like he came in the first 2 weeks or 3 weeks of games or whatever. All he wanted to do was just track pitches and see as many pitches as he could. And then the other day he was kind of like, I've decided to start like participating in games. And he just like mashed two Nathan Eovaldi fastballs, which was his biggest issue last year. So like, all right, if this guy can figure out major league high velocity fastballs, like all of a sudden he's pretty interesting because he looks athletic right now, maybe more so than I viewed him from afar last year. He's taken to first base really well. You know, he's already a guy who can play third, left field, DH. So I don't know. I mean, that's one of those things that maybe we're being fooled by what we're seeing in, you know, just as far as his physicality and his athleticism, but I think he's looked really interesting and certainly a guy that they're going to be counting on more depending on how long G-Man Choi is out. So
good guys, baseball players adjust, right? The thing he was robbed of was time. So I'm exactly. Coming in and just tracking pitches is probably the best thing for him. But the money ball conversation with Ron Washington is a cliche at this point. Like, no, it's really hard to play first base, but I honestly, good baseball players figure it out. I feel like.
Right. And I
you know, Brosseau also missed an easy grounder when Honeywell was on the mound. So yeah, it goes both ways.
Right. Well, I'm reminded of a conversation I had covering the Pirates about Jung Ho-Gang his first season when he came in and Clint Hurdle was talking about like, you know, the idea of struggling or whatever, when you come over, like this guy was the best in his league. Like you can't even imagine what that's like to come over and struggle when you've done nothing but just mash and be a star for your entire career. So throw that on top of just the absolutely bizarre circumstances of last season. It's like, yeah, like I'm sure that was really hard on the guy, but he's coming and he's looked pretty good. So he's definitely one who stood out as far as a guy on the roster. The other ones are kind of obvious. I mean, Shane McClanahan looked insane. Whenever you're throwing 101, 102 with that kind of breaking stuff, you're going to be good sooner rather than later. Wander Franco, I don't think that ball he hit has landed yet. So that one definitely stood out, having not really seen much of him in person. And then Tristan Gray, who we mentioned earlier, has kind of stood out. And Kevin Cash said he's been kind of a standout performer as far as prospects go this spring.
Okay, Gray, not on the top 30, but maybe we should get into it.
Yeah.
Really surprised you had Wander Franco for – I'm just kidding.
That's why I'm the expert putting Wander.
Did you just want to like put Patino or Randy one just so you could get all the headlines and like make, you know, blow up Twitter for a day?
No. Well, the funny thing is actually putting together the list, we can get into the process of it a little bit, but the
top. Yeah, we should start there after we're done talking about the generational talent in the Rays system. We should get to what the experience was. Yeah.
The top eight were kind of out of my hands as far as putting it together. Those are our top 100 guys on MLB Pipeline's list, which was put together before. So even if I wanted to be just like complete troll face, I couldn't be. And I did not want to be, just to be clear.
I personally, I think there's an actual argument to be made to put Randy number one or Randy. I'm trying to work on these pronunciations because the Rays put the pronunciation guide up and it broke my brain a little bit to see that Randy says like Randy. And right. So I'm like, okay, so it's like Yandy Diaz. I already struggle with Yandy and Yandy because the Gandy bridge has broken me. And so every time I see it, I say Andy. And I feel like maybe he doesn't care, but Arozarena just put up the greatest postseason performance of all time. I don't feel like it's absurd to say that guy has done it in the majors and the other guy has not. He could be first.
This is the Harold Reynolds argument that he makes against Jonathan Mayo and Jim Callis at every available opportunity is, you know, how can you say that this guy's better? He hasn't done it before. Randy has done it before. He's done it on the postseason. He's already proven that he can hit these guys. But, you know, the list is so much about total future career value. And the fact that Wander Franco is 20 gives him a pretty big head start in that department.
All right. That I just wanted to give a chance to all of my sabermetrically inclined writers to be mad at me for agreeing with Harold Baines or whatever. Okay. So what was the process like for you?
So coming into the new beat in January, it was something that I had intended to do, which was, you know, helping out with the list. Mike Rosenbaum is a guy who had done the list before. He was let go. And then the list fell entirely to me, which essentially gave me a second full-time job during spring training, at least the early couple of weeks of it. So at that point, I decided that, you know, I'm not necessarily a prospect expert or whatever, but what I am is a reporter. So I just tried to report the hell out of the list and basically contact every single person I know in baseball to ask for their thoughts and evaluations on the system. And I had a ton of help from Mayo and Callis, who I mentioned before, really dug in as far as getting help from the Rays front office for their evaluations on these guys as well. And so a lot of the early stages of it is just reporting.
Sure. And it's getting information. Well, I mean, so to pause right there, this is a good list.
Thank you.
We also at the site try to have the conversations, reach out to scouts if we can, talk to people in the front office and who work for the team, or I've watched the players play live, not just on YouTube or Twit video or whatever the Twitter calls it. Like we try to do the legwork. We try to do the reporting as hobbyists for fun. And sometimes you learn tidbits or things like that. And you very well reported on a lot of information that is out there if you ask around, and I felt really comfortable. Your list was really close to our site's list. Not that that's the barometer, but I was just intrigued by how, you know, was there a symmetry of information, or do we just both have really good opinions?
Well, yes, but also probably more the information thing.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, I think what's really interesting too is that when I was kind of going about it, is that everyone's so eager to talk about the Rays system because it's so good that, like, mm-hmm. you could go to everyone and everyone has scouted the Rays system because there's so many guys and it's so deep, and everyone looks at the system as like, well, maybe we can get like their 45th best prospect because he might not have a path to playing time. So we got to, you know, really do the legwork on the scouting front and evaluate everybody that we can. And I think that does create a lot of information out there about the guys who were being written about. And it certainly helped me as far as reaching out to people in the industry and trying to create a consensus, because that's the other part of it, is like, you can't just take the team's word, you know, as helpful as the Rays were, because you don't know who they're trying to, you know, evaluate or you know, pump up or whatever. But you know, you have,
well, sometimes you can tell as well. you pull up some websites and you're like, yeah, the team told you that.
But I will,
okay, great example is Xavier Edwards in your write-up. That was actually one of the things I sticky noted electronically. The Rays think Edwards will develop more pop as he gets stronger and learns to generate more bat speed, but even then he's unlikely to offer anything more than well below average home run power.
Right.
Do they think he's gonna add pop?
Sure. I mean, everybody does. Like,
right.
You don't look at any player and say like, well, this guy kind of is what he is. I guess that's fine. You know, like, especially somebody that you really believe in the athleticism mm-hmm. and the feel, like, you do just always have the sense that like, this guy's going to gain muscle as he gets older. I mean, he's 21 years old. Like, he has not developed his full like adult strength yet. Like, guys do get, I mean, Greg Jones put on 10 pounds last year and added a ton of power and added loft to his swing. And that made him a different prospect to a certain extent. So like, you know, Xavier Edwards is not going to be a power hitter, but could he have 35 power or whatever instead of 30, or 40 power instead of 30? Like, you still have to hope, hold out hope for that just as player development people. Now, whether or not we have to believe that is a separate issue, but certainly they can hope that and believe that it's coming for him.
Yeah, Edwards is an interesting test case or litmus test for who you get your information from. Keith Law, for instance, is on his island and sometimes has his own hot takes. And I think he called Edwards like a future all-star. I was like, are we sure? And it's interesting because I think everyone looks at Xavier Edwards and sees something slightly different. And the truth is, he's a prospect. Prospects will break your heart, but you know, maybe he'll be really good. Maybe he will be an all-star and that'd be exciting. Right. But it was one of those moments where the Rays say, I was like, yeah, that's probably the right way to couch that statement.
Right, right. Well, because, you know, you certainly want to value their opinion. And again, they have the most firsthand looks at him than anybody, and they've seen the guy and they know more about his information and his makeup and things like that. It is just important to sometimes couch where information's coming from, as opposed to this is, you know, written down, you know, from on atop the mountain, written down in stone, like this is what it is and this is truth. But that is pretty interesting, and talking about like everybody seeing what they want to see and things could change, that I think the smartest thing I heard from anybody while I was putting this entire list together is that it's so hard to evaluate prospects now because they're changing so much, and that is the era in which baseball is right now. It is, you know, the player improvement age. And you see, we talked off the air about Drew Strotman coming in. Like, he wasn't on anybody's radar probably this time a year ago. And then he comes in and he's healthy and he develops a cutter, and all of a sudden he's 22 on our list and protected from the Rule 5 draft. You know, that's sort of the story of modern baseball, is player improvement.
Yeah. So one of the things when I'm looking at this list, and it's, after a while, when you start to read like Baseball America's list and you read like Eric Longenhagen over at Fangraphs or Kylie McDaniel now with ESPN, you kind of get a sense of like what people's eyes are, you know, Jonathan Mayo and Callis, like kind of see where, like, are they upside? Are they the ceiling? Are they really like a nice stable floor with some upside pop? So for you, if you could evaluate yourself when you're looking at guys, you tend to see like high floor and that kind of tends to give you a little extra bump, or do you like the, you know, all risk it for the biscuit like Bruce Arians and want that high ceiling?
So I think I am biased personally toward floor, which is something that I kind of had to fight against when doing this list, because like I look at Josh Fleming and he's in, like, to the Randy argument, like he did it, like he was successful in the majors, like you already know what he is, like this guy's good. Like, I don't, you know, we haven't seen JJ Goss do it in the majors, like how do we know that he's going to be better? But you do have to evaluate, like I said, long-term future career value and say that, all right, you know, maybe that's as good as Josh Fleming's going to be. And maybe he's a 4 or 5, but there is still the hope of the upside of a Goss or a Seth Johnson being a 2 or 3 or whatever. So therefore you have, you know, and they're younger and they haven't proven it yet. So maybe you give them the slight bump based on upside, but that's a really good question, because that is something I fought against a ton doing this list. Like I look at Josh Lowe, for instance, he's 13 on the list we put together, and I felt like that was low, but it was kind of just based on, because in my opinion he's a guy who has both a high the rare high floor and high ceiling, because his floor, just based on his athletic tools, is a fourth outfielder. Like that's a guy who, with the fielding and the arm and the speed, like he's gonna have a spot on a major league roster somewhere. But I ran into a lot of scouts and evaluators with questions about the bat and whether or not the bat was going to come along enough to be an everyday guy. It's like, okay, fine. But if it does, then he's a legitimate everyday center fielder. And that ceiling is higher than, frankly, a 13th best prospect in this system should be, you know, being an everyday quality center fielder with that kind of athleticism and potential hit tool. So that is the challenge of it, is trying to balance floor and ceiling. And I don't think I have a good answer as to how you do it. You just try to build as much consensus and kind of find the middle ground, which is—
I go in the same circle on Josh Lowe specifically, because like, well, if the bat improves, that is like a legit starter. Well, if the bat's improving, that's because he's added power, which probably means he's bulked up, which probably means he's not a center fielder. So is that good? Yep, and then it's just you're going around the drain.
Yep. I had that exact conversation with another evaluator. It's like, you know, if he adds the power, like maybe he's not going to stick in center. If it is that profile play in right field the same way that it doesn't play in center. And it's like the conversation I had more than anything else doing this is with evaluators and scouts saying, I'm glad we just have to evaluate them, not rank them. I'm like, well, thanks. It's literally my job right now to rank them. And, you know, just the, well, this guy keeps changing. So, you know, it's tough to evaluate when they keep changing so much. So it's a fun exercise. And it is funny because I appreciate that you guys have read the blurbs and looked at the blurbs as well, because when you do this, you put so much work into that and the grades and all that part of it. And then people just look at it and they see the list and they're like, well, this list is crappy. Like, your order is wrong. And like, there's a lot more that went into it.
I have the actual numbers.
Right.
There were two cases where the numbers jumped out at me, the grading, not just the overall future value grade, but mm-hmm. I started looking at it and I started doing a comparison in my mind. So one of those was Edwards to Bassa Bay. And mm-hmm. I'm going to hope I'm saying that right. Please forgive me, Oslivas, if that is how you say your first name. Super excited about him. He seems very similar to Edwards overall. The hit tool's close, the run tool's close, the field tool's close. He's got more power. His arm is better. And yet that's a 45 grade instead of a 55 grade for Edwards. And then I felt super conflicted for the context of our conversation. Our writers list is actually four people, average appraisals together, so that we're not coming out with just like, this is Danny's opinion. And we're all trying to do our own research and we hope that makes a better list. But I was the one pounding the table for Bassa because I was like, he's not that different.
Yeah, he's a guy who, to me, when we do the midseason re-rank, could take a pretty big leap based on games played. I mean, that's part of it. It's just that he hasn't mm-hmm. had a ton of professional experience and he hasn't quite proven the tools to the extent maybe that Edwards even has. And we're also, a lot of the times when we do the tools, we're talking about future potential. We don't necessarily do like current future. We focus more on future. And so
it's called a future value grade. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So like, well, I don't even know if we have that written in the thing, which is one thing that it was actually a question I asked when I was doing this. Like, are we talking about right now? Cause like some of these kids probably have like 25 game power right now, but like you're hoping that they're going to project, you know, cause they're 17 and they're not playing in professional baseball or, you know, full season baseball yet. So it is trying to keep in mind that, you know, maybe he's a little farther from having reached the tool grades than Edwards seems to be at this point. So that kind of explains the disparity there. Part mm-hmm. of that was also just that it was pretty clear in the conversations that I had around the industry that Heriberto Hernandez was the first piece in that trade, in the Nate Lowe trade. And then, all right, he's 15. If he's valued less in the Rays' eyes, then Hernandez is, and like how far do we have to drop him down and where does he fit mm-hmm. in all this, and where does he fit? You also do like the game with yourself where you're saying you're basically just ranking within your own list. You're saying, you know, it's, would you take Bassa over Alika Williams? Like, yeah, probably in the long term. Would you take him over Alejandro PA? Like, I don't know. And then you kind of go from there.
To finish out this idea, there was another one. And also in our comment section, some people were trying to make a comparison between Greg Jones and Alika Williams. And that was a moment where I was like, you got to read the write-up because you actually did the research on that. But the thing that, like, Greg Jones was never going to get traded this offseason, for instance, even though he got mocked a lot, maybe even sometimes at our site, because he was constantly changing, as you mentioned, and now he's developing power, which, as you mentioned. And that's a situation where I feel like people look at those two and they're like, it's basically a first round shortstop, why can't I treat them the same? But they are significantly different players at this point in terms of bat speed, loud contact.
Yes, I think there are still a lot of questions about whether Alika Williams is going to be able to impact the baseball enough to not just have the power to play every day, but also even to kind of get to his hit tool to a certain extent. You know, are these ball is going to be off the ground, or are they going to be able to find gaps and stuff like that? Or is Greg Jones developing the power, adding a little more loft to the swing, I think has changed his evaluation in a lot of people's eyes, just as far as what he could become. And you also know that, like, maybe there's a path to playing time in center field with him based on the athleticism. And Williams has the floor, again, of like a really good defensive shortstop. But the comparison I made that I heard, conveniently enough for me, because I knew the player, was Kevin Newman with the Pirates. And it's like, when Kevin Newman hits for average, he's an everyday shortstop. When he doesn't, he's a bench player at best. And mm-hmm. that, to me, is kind of where Alika Williams falls. Whereas Greg Jones is obviously more there.
Yeah.
Since we brought up the Nate Lowe trade, let's talk about the guy that was the top of that, Heriberto Hernandez. listed as a catcher slash right fielder slash DH. Those are very different outcomes. I mean, the bat, the numbers in the minors, the write-ups, the scouting is unbelievable. It's one of the most exciting bats in all of minor league baseball. That position, though, if that comes in a catcher, holy crap. Right fielder, still love that bat. So what's the status of him as a catcher?
They're going to try him out. They're going to give him every chance. The sense that I got is that they think he has like the tools and the athleticism to do it. They just, he's raw. I mean, he hasn't had a lot of maybe instruction in the sense of where he needs to get better. And I think they're pretty confident in what they can do once they get their hands on him, just improving him behind the plate. And he's another guy that, like, let's say there's an electronic strike zone. All of a sudden you're going to see a lot of DHs behind the plate, and he's a guy who would play pretty well there if he can just figure out the basic, you know, kind of catch and throw stuff a little bit better. But they are really excited about the bat from the sense that I've gotten. I know I talked to other people who saw him in complex league ball, who said just what he was doing with the loud contact and the exit velocities was really special. So the Rays are basically just going to give him every path to playing time. And I think you'll probably go down the position spectrum. You'll go catcher. All right, does this work? Cool. If not, right field. Does this work? If not, first base. If not, you're a DH. But they still believe in the bat enough to have had him be the lead piece in that trade.
Between Hernandez, Heriberto specifically, Ford Proctor, trading for Mejia, why do the Rays think they can just teach anyone how to catch?
Hubris, maybe? No.
Electronic strike zone coming a lot sooner, and they have the inside information.
That's honestly, like, I do think that a lot of teams are making some evaluations for future catchers based on that. It's just the idea that, like, let's take a chance, and if this works out, cool. But Mejia, I think they're also just buying into the bat as well, that, like, they think he's could still be the guy that he was as a prospect in Cleveland's system before he was even in San Diego. I think they like the bat, and they think he's, again, got, like, the basic tools and athleticism necessary to be a good catcher back there. And one thing they want him to do, I think, is be a little bit more vocal with the pitching staff as far as game planning and stuff like that.
Mejia.
That was a little bit of a knock on him, that he was like kind of passive as a game caller before. And so they've really encouraged him to be vocal and talk through game plans. And to me, it has stood out that he's worked really well with Michael Wacha this spring, because Wacha is a veteran who's come in with ideas and said, this is what I want to do. This is what I would like to work on. And I think it's worked out pretty well for him. You know, how well is he going to be? Is he going to be a plus catcher? Like, I don't know, probably not. But if he can even be serviceable with the upside of his bat, then it's an interesting player. And the same thing with Proctor, kind of a catcher conversion. Somebody I just wrote about, having played in the Australian Winter League. Mm-hmm. They love the makeup of that guy. Like the fact that he basically said, like, I realize that my path to playing time is blocked in the infield. What can I do? Like, I'll catch. That stood out to them. And I heard some people say, evaluating the organization from outside, that like he might have been their best catcher in Instruct by the time it was all said and done. And that was pre Blake Hunt.
Right.
But that's still a pretty interesting player. If he's able to stick behind the plate with electronic strikes,
I mean, or not. Instructs though. I gave Eric a bunch of crap about this too. How much can you trust improvements in non-competitive situations? Blake Hunt picking up a new swing in 2020 is the most nerve-wracking thing I can think. I mean, trust your scouts, trust your people if they think it's legit. And Eric's argument, his rebuttal to me in that was, well, he came into power too. Is that, you know, that's not something you can fake. So he had a lot of faith in the bat, but he traded for him.
Right. Yeah.
What's your appraisal on Hunt?
So the thing that stood out to me in talking to people is that they had believed in the swing before. They just didn't know if there was necessarily going to be the impact and the power. And then I joked about this with Jonathan Mayo. Two different people used the word strapping to describe the way that he looked at Instructs, like physically. So the point that I think I used the word in the write-up, because I said, if one person had said it, I don't think I have to use strapping. That's weird. If two people say it, I am required to say that he looked strapping. It's just, but he's, you know, he's a big physical catcher, the kind that you do expect some power from, just the way that he's built. And I think they were really big believers in the defense before. They thought that at worst, he was going to be like a really quality defender, catch and throw type guy. And then they did see the physicality change, which, you know, you can kind of shake your head at it and wonder like, all right, well, how much is that really going to change his profile? To which I would say, have you seen Randy Arozarena? what was he heading into quarantine? What was he coming out of quarantine? The difference is essentially the physicality and the way that his body changed and the muscle that he added and the fact that he came in and all of a sudden he was strapping and he's able to hit the ball in the air and more power to his game as well. So that turns an interesting player, you know, kind of maybe a high floor backup type reserve into a much more interesting player. And I think that's where you have to trust your scouts is not judging results in instructs, but what they're seeing. And that is the value of having scouts ultimately.
The full quote is Hunt is a big, strong, strapping presence at 6'4".
Got his height and strapping in there. So it was a brief moment of pride. I think that there are times where you're doing these things and, you know, it's three paragraphs, about 30 guys. And it's, I think, let me open the doc here for how long that actual write-up was.
Oh, for
11,362 words of prospect write-ups. So the fun I had of it, I think, was the strapping. And then there is a very brief Simpsons reference in the Taj Bradley write-up that he would not be a Gamecock.
That one actually went over my head. I feel bad about it.
But it was true. He didn't go to South Carolina. He would not be a Gamecock.
We've talked a lot about some shortstops, but we have to talk about the guy who's maybe gotten as much hype or up there with like Wander in terms of just not necessarily hype, but talk. Like everybody has mentioned
Secrets out.
Taylor Walls. Everybody is talking about Taylor Walls. And he comes in number 9 on your list. Nice aggressive ranking. Like we said, this is, you know, we had him pretty high up. It might have something to do with our editor-in-chief going to Florida State as well. Who knows? There might be some.
Oh, no.
Who knows? There might be some of that there.
Adam went to Florida.
Oh, yeah, I'm a Florida guy. Florida man.
Yeah.
I was going to try not to go there. So did my dad. Yeah. I'm the black sheep of the family. It's fine.
So, Taylor Walls, number 9. Yeah, the secret's out, apparently. Everybody's
talking about it. Well, it wasn't a total secret. He was the defensive player of the year twice.
Yeah.
If they had awarded it in 2020, I'm sure he would have won it again, right? It's not like it was a secret that he was really a good defender, but the fact that he was the real deal, the full, as a switch hitter who was hitting well in instructs, you know, again, take it or leave it.
Right.
But a player who came into his own at this point, if the Rays had traded Adames, as the rumor eventually got out there, I would not have been surprised because there's an answer in-house ready to go.
Yeah. And
that was a 65 grade on his defense. And that's a 65 grade at a shortstop. That is eye-opening.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of like, you know, Kiermaier, the infield talk when you hear about him. Is it like, you know, maybe if you just watch him one time, it doesn't necessarily stand out, but over time you see him and it's just, this guy makes plays that other people don't make consistently. And he does the routine play routinely. Like, it's all of the praise that you hear about every defender wrapped up in one guy at a premium position. And then again, it's a high floor type profile because the on-base percentage is going to be so good that even if it stays gap power as a switch hitter, that's a really useful player. Even if there's not a path to everyday playing time at shortstop because of Juan Franco or whoever else, like, this is a really interesting player and the industry as a whole saw it too. I think that was one reason I was probably a little bit more aggressive in bumping him up the list was not just what the Rays said about him, which, as you've probably heard, is, you know, just praise like crazy. It's, you know, they love everything he does.
Elite footwork, God's gift to defense. Yes.
Right. Yeah. It was outside the organization. People saying that, like, he might be a top 5 guy in their system based on our evaluation, or he should be a top 100 prospect on your list. And I said, I didn't make the list. Please don't judge me about the top 100. There was just so much praise from inside and outside the organization, especially when it's coming from outside and how he's valued. You can also learn a lot about this player's value as far as who's being asked for in trades, I think.
Exactly. Yeah, so that's exactly where my brain was going. It's definitely a player at this point that other people ask for.
Right, because they see, well, you got Wander, you got Willie, you got a lot of guys, you know, a lot of just nothing but middle infielders in the system potentially blocking his playing time. You know, this is a guy who could be had, and certainly that's going to come up a lot. And the fact that the Rays have kept him, obviously, I think says a lot about how they view him. And combine all of that, and I think that goes into the Rays.
What's the future infield? Departing the list for a hot second. If you had to look into your crystal ball, what is the future infield 1.5 years from now when it's just prospects?
the toughest one there to do is first base, isn't it?
I know. Like, yeah, it is.
That's, I don't know why I'm trying to start there, because that's the hardest one to do, but you probably have Wander at third.
Yeah, that's where I'm at.
Taylor Walls at shortstop. You could do Brujan at second base. I find what they're doing with him, trying to basically make him Ketel Marte, really interesting, because, but then like they have so many outfielders too, that like maybe you don't need him to be an everyday guy in the outfield. So I pencil him at second base. And then somebody playing first base.
It works itself out.
Maybe Hernandez isn't going to be there in a year and a half. Kevin Padlo will still be around at that point, I would suspect.
I feel like he's the next trade chip, following in the footsteps of Nick Solak and Nate Lowe. I'm sure the Rangers are very interested in Kevin Padlo.
The only reason I'm hedging against that, because I do think that makes sense, especially as they get toward the end of spring training and you might need to clear out a 40-man spot for a non-roster invitee on the pitching staff, that it might make sense to move a guy like that. But just given the injuries, and you know, you're now a Yandy Diaz like slip on a base, or a Yoshi Tsugo slip on a base away from like Kevin Padlo playing a pretty prominent role on your roster pretty soon. So major league ready depth is important, and he certainly seems to be that.
I want Walls up. I agree. Shortstop of the future.
Well, but then you go through the list and there are just so many shortstops of the future.
But Greg Jones isn't sure. Well, actually, well, Greg Jones could be here. So I said a year and a half. So is it possible that mid-22 Greg Jones is ready? Sure. It would be the most surprising thing that's ever happened. I would guess 23, but
yeah,
if he's just lights out in the minors.
Right. That was the other tough part of doing that, is the ETAs that go on these lists. Sure. Like after last year, you're really just kind of like throwing your hands up and say, I don't know, man, like we'll see when they come in to start playing where they are. The only ones that you feel really good about really are the 2021 guys. And there are a ton of them because you know that they're on the verge of helping out very soon. And that was tough. But like when we put 2025 on, Bitsko and Colmenares, and it's just like the year 2025 is like an abstract concept in my mind right now. Like I can't imagine what the Rays, much less like baseball, much less the world looks like at that point. But you know, you're projecting forward and trying to.
I did appreciate you had the classic MLB pipeline first round draft picks go like in the top 10. Now this is a deep system, so there's a little bit of pushing down, but Bitsko and Wilcox are, I guess, 12 and 11, respectively. Yeah. I was like, it's a pipeline list. You have to do that.
Right. Well, one thing we actually try to be mindful of, and I think it speaks to Colmenares being 18, despite how new he is, and Yan Diaz being 30th, is we've done a lot of looking at where stars come from and where impact players come from. And it's overwhelmingly, at this point, like the international market is so well represented among like the best players in the game. It's like, are we doing our part in that, in accounting for them on the way up? Because the easy thing to do when you're talking about an international prospect is like high floor, low, you know, or high ceiling, low floor. We'll see what happens. And, you know, we'll get to you when they're in AAA and we have a little bit of a better idea. But trying to project out a little bit more, which is why you see those guys on the list. And you still do have to account for kind of following the money with a guy like Wilcox and another guy like Bitsko, that if a team is willing to pay that kind of signing bonus, they clearly believe in the potential and the upside, and therefore we kind of have to judge accordingly. Bitsko is a tough one to place on this list. I mean, we put him 12 because of the upside, but coming back from a surgery, it's hard to say. You know, I could just as easily have flip-flopped, to take it back to the start of the entire conversation, Honeywell and Bitsko, and put Honeywell 12, because like if he comes back all the way, he's still every bit the high upside guy that he was before. There's just less time to prove it and to play that, you know, at that level, given the fact that he's 25 now. But it's tough, man. It's an inexact science, and you have a lot of questions like that, injuries, and you know, we ranked Seymour above Williams, and I got some crap for that. We're like, well, which one did they just pick first? Which one did they just pick ahead of the other one? And now you know, go ahead and do this, but. That's for, again, prospects are constantly changing and the information's changing, and you try to balance it all to the extent that you're able.
So let's move it back to the 2021 and keep it focused, because there is a lot of like the list of people who prospects in this deep, deep system that are pretty much ready. And again, like you said, with last year, that sort of makes things a little bit tougher. Like a guy like Wander Franco, hasn't played above double A. He hasn't played a single game of double A yet. Like, so that does kind of push his timeline a little bit off. But let's talk about a guy that did appear in the majors and a guy that really took the storm, your number two and number three, the tougher spot, because Wander's number one. Everybody, he's, you know, generational, maybe the best prospect ever as prospects go.
Okay. Of the last decade.
I mean, we're, some people talk ever? About like Bryce and yeah, I mean, we're number ones overall back to back. That's a debate. That's a weird debate for people many years because it's just prospects and we'll know in the majors what happens, but that can be a fun debate. Like JJ Cooper and, you know, Callis and all the prospect heads can talk
yeah,
about
yeah. Mayo.
But number two, number three, Patino or Rosarena. Back to Danny's point, Randy merges superstar, goes from being a kind of a middle of the pack prospect when the Rays acquired him to breaking Barry Bonds postseason records. Amazing. Luis Patino, one of the top right-handed pitching prospects in all of baseball, one of the top pitching prospects in all of baseball. Unbelievable electric stuff. Mm-hmm. He's number two on your list ahead of Randy. So can you talk
which is not your doing. Patino? Just recognizing that.
Right.
This is this being is given that. That ranking and needing to write up Patino.
Do you, one, agree with that in your own, if you could rank him? And two, can you talk a little bit about where Patino fits in to this 2021? Because he was up last year in a smaller role because Padres were, had no pitching at all. And he did leapfrog Mackenzie Gore in that call up. So what do you see his role is here? And how do you, in your own personal list, put Patino and Randy?
Yeah, that's tough. And I think they're both, we had them both at six. No, we had Randy at 55 overall future value. Again, that wasn't my call totally in the end there, but to me, they could both be 60s and Patino probably gets the edge because he's just younger. You know, there's more time for him to tap into it. And the value of a potential number one, number two type starter, they're probably a little more rare than an outfielder who hits for power. But then again, I'm about to run myself in circles. Like, what if they hit for Randy's power last October over a full season? Those guys don't throw on trees either. So how much more valuable is that than your average number two starter? You can work yourself silly trying to straighten out these logical knots in your head. But to me, Patino is just because the stuff is so electric. The upside is that of a top of the rotation type pitcher. Soon, you know, he could be, I suspect he's one of their next men up as far as the rotation goes. You know, if Fleming doesn't make the bullpen, he'd probably be the next one up. McClanahan is on that list. And then it's probably Patino based on the major league experience and the quality of the stuff. I think he could break into the big leagues in any number of roles this year, whether it's a multi-inning reliever, a bulk guy, you know, a starter, a quasi-starter based on the way that they're going to use pitchers this year. But I think the hope there is that there is still just that upside that eventually he's going to establish himself as a top of the rotation type starter. And whether they can ease him into that kind of role this year, probably more likely. But they definitely like the guy. The industry's been high on him forever. I mean, when you have that kind of fastball, that just a swing and miss electric, like top of the zone type fastball, then, you know, you already have the makings of a really good starting pitcher with the rest of his arsenal.
Is that the Adam Berry appraisal or is that the industry appraisal?
Both. I'm okay. Pretty much on board with
it's
what
fair.
They have to say.
I am really nervous when people say this is a frontline starter, a potential number one. I'm like, the track record is really short. And right. I mean, he's adding strength, right? He's hitting 99, but then I just watched him do it in the postseason and it was, I don't know.
Yeah, no, I mean, the whole, like, there is no such thing as a pitching prospect. Like, that's real. But, like, eventually, at a certain point, you do have to bet on some of these guys.
Yeah.
you try to take the safest bets. And to me, Luis Patino is another one of those with the high floor, high ceiling.
El Electrico.
El Electrico, that's right. Like, worst case scenario, he's going to be, like, a dominant late inning arm, right? Like, that's your worst case scenario, just with the fastball that he has. And then best case, he figures it out, the command's there, the off-speed stuff all comes along to complement the fastball, and he's a legitimate top of the rotation type starter. Yeah, that's tough. And again, like going back to the what do you value thing, like if it was just me, like I'd probably just have like position players in the top 10 spots because it's like these guys are safe, you know what they're going to be. Like it's pretty easy, you know, it's easier to predict position player health, but you do have to take some bets with pitchers. I would have liked to move Shane McClanahan up personally if I had a little more control of the top eight, because I think and that's another one too, that he changed a lot in the offseason. You know, the slider, the command that he showed coming into spring training was really impressive. Just the strike throwing, the commitment to the zone. The fact that he is just casually 101 right out of the chute in spring training, like, that's a really interesting pitcher to me. And if that all plays out, then, like, I'm probably going to look stupid in a couple of years having had him number six, even in this system.
Him and Patino are interesting because they did, like, to Danny's point, like, they both struggled in their very limited time in the majors and in the postseason, but they're also, 22 and 20, and they called up in the most, like, traumatic year in the history of the planet. And so there's, like, this, like, really, there's a lot of, like, asterisk to that, where it's like,
and we're spoiled by David Price, who has forever broken me on these high end prospects through Vanderbilt getting,
and
I know, but that, like, they get promoted into the show in the postseason. I expect them to work the same.
Right. And I mean, Randy is going to spoil a lot of people too. But, like, he comes up and he's just this guy right away. And then how come that you know, everybody can't be this? I saw it in Pittsburgh with Cabrian Hayes, that, like, there were questions about the bat all coming through the minors. Then all of a sudden he comes up in September and he's a monster, you know, for average and power. It's like, you know, is that sustainable? I don't know, but it does, even that small sample size so significantly changes your perception of the player that it really does help to just have a lot of evaluation, a lot of information, a lot of data to kind of fall back on, and information even being just scouting reports from the past. And scouting, you know, evaluations and everything like that.
A guy who fits into the same framework. We would be remiss not to talk about Shane Baz. Your write-up was a tale as old as time. This dude is a Pirates pitcher who throws a two-seamer and he leaves and he stops throwing a two-seamer and now he's good. At the top of the pod, it sounds like maybe the Pirates are moving away from that curse of we make everyone throw a two-seamer. But I did enjoy reading that in the write-up of, like, oh yeah, this is what happened to him.
Yeah, that one came pretty naturally for me to write. I've told the story elsewhere before on the radio and other podcasts and stuff, but, like, it killed me to no end to hear Shane Baz. I think when it was with MILB.com when he first got traded, and he talked to somebody and it was like, you know, I sat down with the Rays and they told me how great, like, the spin rate on my fastball was. And he's like, and I didn't even know that coming from the Pirates. They wanted me to throw a two-seamer instead. And it's one of those things that, like, I had heard from, like, the Pirates scouts and the, you know, the people who made the decision on draft day, that, like, this guy has a high spin fastball. It's really going to play well. Like, you know, you love to see it at the top of the zone. Like, you know, it all plays off of that high spin fastball, but then he gets into the system and he's not informed of that information and he's not apprised about how to use it. And that's one thing that stands out about the Rays development system and just the organization as a whole, is the way that they communicate information and make it actionable for these guys. So even a kid who is 21 understands what that means and how it can benefit him. And you saw him come into big league camp and he looked so mature, just the way that he pitched, despite his age and despite his inexperience. That's another high upside arm that kind of fits in, like you said, like in that Patino McClanahan type high floor of a late inning relief arm with, you know, the ceiling of a really, really interesting, you know, top of the rotation type starter if he figures it all out and the command sticks.
So now I kind of want to jump to the bottom of the list and actually off of the list, because the interesting thing with the Rays, I think Longenhagen had like 46 or 48 for that he did a write-up of, some insane number. Who just missed your kind of top 30, or if you want to think of it in a different way, who are you most excited about that's not on the top 30?
I think we wrote Pedro Martinez was the one who was just off the list. Like, he's our 31. So he's one definitely to watch, and he could have just as easily been on the list. You know, those last couple of spots, he was in the mix. Nick Schnell is pretty close as far as being in that next group. One of the more interesting arms that kind of came about as I was doing the reporting for this is Sandy Gastone. He was like a real arm speed type of signing who apparently has really started to put it together as far as the velocity and the consistency of the delivery and the location and all that kind of stuff. He is definitely going to be one that I watch. Caleb Sampson is a name who came out as a potential sleeper, a potential breakout guy.
Sure.
Somebody that they probably could have moved faster in 2019 and definitely has the stuff to succeed. Wherever they put him,
that's a classic. The Rays just promoted this guy. You've never heard of him.
right. And all of a sudden he has like a dominant pitch and it completely works for him. Neraldo Catalina. That's another one I want to throw out there. He's
the wine mixer.
Yes. is another arm strength kind of fastball velocity type guy.
That was the guy where he got traded to the Rays, and they were like, this is a Mets top 15 prospect. And he's not going to be in the top 50 for this initial Rays list.
Yeah, he falls in that kind of, 37 to 46, 50 type range. Evan Edwards, another guy they acquired from the Marlins in the John Curtis trade. He was in that. I think I had him initially.
So he's not even so any trades that happen after I've made my list, I feel like. Tell me about him. I have not researched appropriately.
Yeah, let me pull up my notes here. He was a guy that the Rays were
I made some Twitter jokes about him, but outside of that.
What were the subjects of the Twitter jokes?
It was Evan is my new best friend. You know that meme where it's like you cross out the old guy and then this is my new best friend? Okay. I crossed out Evan Longoria and anyway, never mind. Go ahead. I have a new Evan in my life. That's right. My point.
This is the segment of the pod where we explain memes.
We explain
Visual jokes in an audio medium, yeah.
Like, you know, so it's this guy. It's clearly a boyfriend walking with a girl, but he's looking at the one behind him. And that's the funny part is that he's not looking at the one he's with.
And that's Caleb Sampson.
Right. So Evan Edwards, like, he's the guy that Jim Callis had told me, like, because I think he does the Marlins system for us. He said the Rays were just basically stalking him all offseason. It's a guy that they were clearly really interested in.
Fascinating.
Power over hit right now, but he's got power to all fields. Exit velocity is good. Limited to first base, but he's going to play first base and he's going to play it pretty well. So that's not like the most exciting profile, probably. You know, You really have to have like an elite bat to profile on a top 30 list as a first baseman who's limited there, but an interesting player. And it's another one of those things to me that this team and this organization does so well, that they take somebody like Curtis, who might not make the team and might have to get shoved off the 40-man roster at some point, and you turn him into an asset off the 40-man roster who could fill a position of need in a couple years. And just that constant churn. And even, I mean, it's the same thing with Nate Lowe, turning him into Heriberto and Basabe. It's a really interesting churn, the way they do things. And the fact that they have tried to set themselves up to contend year in and year out for a long time. This is how you do it. You make smart trades like that, that may not look like much at the time, but they add value to the organization.
What about, so who are you buying stock in? So if the Rays prospects are stocks to invest in, like, what's your GME? What's your AMC? Where are you putting your money? Moon. Rocket ship to the moon.
And
Adam Berry appraisal, not industry appraisal, not MLB.com appraisal.
I mean, I think I've probably given sufficient love to Shane McClanahan during all this. Like,
yeah, I mean, I feel it. Him and Tristan Gray are your boys.
I didn't necessarily say that, but Tristan Gray's an interesting player. But McClanahan is up there.
You can
walk
me back. It's fine.
Joe Ryan. We haven't even talked about Joe Ryan once.
We did. I was actually peeking at those. I was like, we should probably go through and
the invisible fastball.
See who do we barely talked about Vidal Brujan, future center fielder, Brendan McKay. I don't
Brendan
know.
McKay
coming off.
Hard
exploratory
to say.
Shoulder surgery and then cut his hand open. I mean, I think I did that in college once too, so I get it.
I'm glad that I don't have to explain my injuries, because like me just not being able to for work.
Baseball, like in hockey, it's just like, oh, lower body injury.
Right.
And then there's no answer. JJ Goss. JJ Goss feels like a dude who's going to get traded. It's one of those prospects that the industry just can clearly look at him and say, I know what that is. I feel like there's a couple prospects on this list that are almost fungible in that way, in which like the Rays would probably appraise this guy a certain way. And there's not a disinformation with the outside, like Greg Jones over the offseason, probably there was disinformation, or Stroutman adds a pitch and you're protected from the Rule 5 draft because, you know, the information is not flowing the right way. I feel like JJ Goss is what he is. And it's very easy to understand what he is. And therefore, I feel like he's getting traded because I feel like the outside probably agrees with the internal evaluation. I don't know.
Certainly possible. I'm not going to try to say that a 20-year-old is going to have to get traded and prepare for that possibility. But
that's not news. I'm sorry. I'm just trying to when I was looking at this list, one of the things, Edwards is one of those for me, too. Now the Rays acquired him. But it would not shock me if the Rays moved him, because I feel like everyone has the same appraisal Now, we talked about the range of what the possibilities are, but he is what he is, and there's not like mystery.
I think that's an interesting way of looking at it. And when you say that the Rays don't see more in a guy than the rest of the industry sees, then yeah, there probably is more likelihood of somebody being traded. Just because
that's how I approach the list sometimes, as I look at it, I'm like, who's here and who can I plug into the MLB trade values trade machine?
So cold and calculated.
I know.
That's an interesting.
Sorry, JJ, if you're listening.
But let's not jump off of Joe Ryan, though, because that is a guy that does feel like the most Raisy type of, like, if you just look at him, you're like, oh, that's, he's not, but that's the type of guy with a weird thing that, so like a Colin Poche type of fastball where you're like, that doesn't jump off the radar. It doesn't even jump off the spin, but there is something to it that is super special.
Yeah, and that's where you have to evaluate your own guys and understand what makes them good, which is what the Rays do well, which is why I think they trade people at the right time as well, and why they place value in the right prospects, which would include a Joe Ryan. Because that's, I don't know, I wasn't following the system all that closely before this past year, but I would be really curious from you guys, like, coming into last spring training, was there like a big Joe Ryan rocket to the moon, to borrow your phrase,
hype train? There was a lot of talk. There was enough smoke that you're like, there is something here.
Okay.
Like a Taylor Walls almost type of thing where you're like, this guy keeps getting brought up.
Sorry, I should have said coming into 2019 before he had that insane like 2 ERA where he skipped three levels.
Yeah.
That was the commentary. Yeah. Was that, he was in the Cape Cod League. Let me go back in my brain. wait, we should just go to your write-up. You walked through it.
Ryan jumped onto the draft radar during the 2016 Cape Cod League season, but went unselected due to lat and shoulder injuries. It's all right there in the write-up, man.
Well, did you put Invisible in? No, it's the Poche fastball, right? I remember when Poche was traded for, there was like, oh, this is similar to this kid, Joe Ryan, right?
Okay.
There were similarities in fastball, but there wasn't a 2 ERA expectation being slapped on that, right? Right. And Poche is the context of a reliever who, if he just picks up a secondary, this is, you know, something special and you can ride the rocket ship.
Right. And that is why I think that question about the secondary and the need for that as a starting pitcher is why he is 14. I got a little bit of grief for having him just internally from our own prospect people about having him 14 based on the results and the proximity to the majors. But he's done what he's done, mostly against lower level hitters, with the success of that one pitch, which is unhittable and nasty and gives him, again, a high floor and some certainty to a certain extent because nobody can hit that thing. But, you know, upper level hitters are a little tougher, especially when scouting reports get out and there's more film and there's a little bit more information out on you. How is the secondary stuff going to come along? And by all accounts, it's come along really well. And he looked good this spring and he threw a little bit more of it. So that was part of the reasoning and having him at 14, because you could very easily make an argument to me, again, a guy who prioritizes floor, that like, maybe you put him above Bitsko and maybe you put him above Wilcox just because of the certainty there and the nastiness of that one pitch and the proven results, but still a little bit of questions as far as the ability to prove it at the upper levels. So he's another one who could, to the extent that there's room to leap up this list, like, he's another one who could take a pretty big leap in the midseason re-ranking.
He's one of the guys, I mean, everyone suffers from there not being a 2020 season, but if AAA happens last year,
yep,
and we see what Joe Ryan looks like in AAA, because I mean, AA guys can't even hit secondaries, I'm not you know, so if he's fooling them, I guess that's fine, but like, I feel like AAA is going to be the real test.
Right, right. Once you start seeing those guys who have major league experience getting at bats against them regularly, and there are fewer holes in the lineup, I think, that'll be the big test. But boy, I can tell you that's a guy the Rays are super high on. And I think if this was just the Rays list, like, he'd probably be higher up than that.
I like that you had the Matt Cain comp on his delivery.
You know what's funny is that we talked to Joe Ryan in spring training like the day after I did this profile. So even like Mark Topkin and even Neil Solons were kind of like, you were really oddly prepared for this Joe Ryan interview, Adam. Like, how come you had so many questions?
He's my cousin. Ryan?
Right. but like, I just threw like shot in the dark, you know, where he grew up and the comps that I'd heard on him. I was like, any chance that like you're a Matt Cain fan? And like, Matt Cain is like his pitching idol who shares an agent with him. And like, I believe shares an equipment company with him. So like, he got Matt Cain signed equipment and like that comparison meant a ton to him. Wow. But I saw Matt Cain up close and personal in 2011 when I was an associate reporter for MLB.com covering the Giants. And
2011,
honestly, like 2011,
an odd year.
Correct. That is my luck in life, is covering an odd year early 2010s Giants team. But that comparison stood out like the first time I saw the guy and heard about him. So like nobody could explain Matt Cain's fastball, but it had that, like, I'm sure now we would say that it has like the rise or like the spin rate or whatever it may be. But it just played so well at the top of the zone, despite the lack of obvious dominant velocity. This seems to be the same thing with Ryan. And it was too crazy to me that like he idolized him growing up and all that kind of stuff.
We skipped over Seth Johnson as well. And that might be the biggest disparity between the D-Rays Bay writers and your list, because we actually put Seth Johnson in the top 10. Super aggressive. Maybe we're hearing too much from Rays folks on that one as well.
Could be. I mean, that's another one that like the upside is so high, but like you could say he's 10, you could say he's above Wilcox and Ditzko, and I can't really disagree with you necessarily based on the upside there. It was just tough for me to do given the lack of innings, basically the lack of information and the lack of kind of scouting data out there on him from as far as professional experience, but certainly a guy who I know the Rays are super high on. It also just gets tough to find room for some of these guys in like the top 10 or whatever. If you look at the list and the way that it's all structured and everything, like
it's deep.
If you want to back down from there to like that 18 through 21 mix, it's terrible to me that they're all that low, but like there's just nowhere else to put them above them, you know, above where
they
are.
We could be a month away. So Franco doesn't really count, right? He might as well get a zero, not a one. It's a different list entirely. Patino is almost off of this list, kind of. Rosarena, it's weird that he's still a prospect. McKay is an inning away from not being a prospect. Taylor Walls, if Adamas was traded, is no longer a prospect. I feel like this list collapses very quickly.
Sure, but I mean, then it just speaks to the depth of the system that like the next however many guys up are still going to be like 40 or to 45 future value type guys, just because they're so good. Like that was a conversation we had in doing the list, is that like we have the last guy on the list is a 45 overall, which is preposterous. Like that is insane. And I was like, are we being too aggressive on these guys? And Jonathan Mayo, like my prospect sage, just comes down to me and says, you know, they're the top ranked system for a reason. Okay. It's reassuring. Thank you. Because, I mean, you know, the information you get in the reports, sometimes you're like, man, am I buying into the hype too much? But no, the hype is real and it's out there for a reason.
What's your feel for Taj Bradley? We mentioned him as not being a game
talk.
I want to circle back on him because I feel like he has believers and then he has doubters.
So let me find, I believe he was a guy that I had a really, really positive report on from outside the organization.
Absolutely. To read from your profile real quick, one scout said he saw Bradley averaging 95 with huge vertical break on his fastball, flashing a plus curveball and instructs. I was ready with the trigger.
That was very much the one. Yeah. I mean, just somebody else said that like every time they see the guy, he gets better. And so you start to believe in
true 12-6 curve.
Yeah. I mean,
even though the slider is his primary.
Right. Which is insane. I mean, if he's developing a legitimate second off-speed, you know, breaking ball that can be an out pitch, like that's again, like the upside there is crazy. And again, that gives him another high floor too. Whereas if you can't repeat the delivery enough to get out, you know, multiple times through the order, it's a really good reliever. Especially if you're, I mean, if you throw 95 with the curveball that he showed in instructs, then like, there you go. that's an interesting player as it is. So that was kind of the genesis of the ranking there, is just the reports. I mean, we already knew what he was. It was a really interesting prospect based on what he did, especially in 2019 on the field in game action. But then the reports as far as how he used the quote unquote lost year and the way that he looked coming in instructs was
right. Strength really was up. What we were hearing is like up to 97, not just, well, sitting 95, right? I think is your write up.
Right. Right.
He's just getting stronger and stronger.
Yep. It just getting bigger, getting stronger, seems to have a better feel for what he's doing every time out. A guy who, whether he's taking to the data of it or just heeding instruction well, like the pitches seem to be taking better shape, a little more refinement to them, playing off of each other better, the whole tunneling type thing. So really interesting. Another guy who I'd probably buy stock in him as well.
Well, yeah, that we need to come. So the only other guy we didn't talk about is Ian Seymour, sort of. So who are you buying stock in now that we've covered the whole 30?
It's impossible to limit it to just a few because, like, you also get attached to guys when you do this list. Like, you feel like you've heard nothing but good things about them, which is the tough part about writing about prospects is that, like, you generally only mention them when they're good. So, like, when all of a sudden they fail for the first time, everybody's like, wait, wait a second. This guy's never made an out and never not had a 10 strikeout game in his entire career.
Would it be easier to short a stock? That's not kind.
No, that's a little.
I'm not going to put you on my end. It's fine. All right, I'm buying stock in Fleming. That's going to be my takeaway. Yeah. Because the
nice gold, solid yield, safe floor.
Absolutely.
Ooh, I like long that.
Term.
He's my rocket mortgage on the he's paying a dividend out tomorrow. It's just the better Yarbrough. It's Ryan Yarbrough, but give him Alex Cobb's fastball or whatever.
Yeah.
And ground ball percentage.
If you can do that, and Yarbrough is throwing second in this race rotation, then where's Fleming if he's better than that, right? Why on earth are we ranking him, you know, in the bottom of the top 20? It's so difficult.
Right. Well, it's one of those things too that, like, so you look at the fastball grade on him as a 50, but, like, if you look at that, and a lot of that's based on velocity, which is obviously isn't great, but what we've tried to be a little more mindful of is, like, movement characteristics. And if you look at people who threw sinkers last year in the majors, like, he had some of the biggest break on his sinker and movement of anybody. So, like, maybe it's, you know, 40 fastball velocity, but it's 60 fastball movement. So then we just kind of average it out at a 50 and how that pitch plays. But he's a guy who gets hurt by scouting grades, essentially, as opposed to results. And, you know, it's not the same direct Matt Cain comparison that Joe Ryan gets, but it's the same way that it could just be a guy who outperforms his tools or whatever for a long time. And that's a really valuable pitcher. He's a guy who I would agree could definitely be ranked higher based on performance, but future value and all that. He's 24, probably upside of a 3 or 4 type starter, unless you want to say he's better than Ryan Yarbrough as the number 2 in this current rotation. he's definitely a guy that I would buy stock in as well. Really, it's a smart guy, knows what he's doing, like all the intangible stuff as well. Like the makeup is incredible. Even if he doesn't eat vegetables, which we've learned this spring, very strange thing.
He's getting there. He's learning.
Well, that was actually funny.
Thank you, Pete Fairbanks.
That was a funny thing about like why he had so few offers out of high school is that like he was so skinny because he basically just didn't eat. Because he was such a picky eater, so then he went to the school, built, you know, got in the weight room, built up a little bit more, and then all of a sudden he was this really good prospect coming out of college that turned into a really interesting major league pitcher. He's one I buy stock in for sure.
With Fleming, that's an interesting spot because he might be on the major league roster. They might leave him down to stretch out like that. There's a bit of game idea there where you need people that can throw multiple innings because you do have a very veteran and injury prone. I mean, Colin McHugh, Archer, and Rich Hill have all had missed time with injuries or were recovering from injuries. So you, and everybody in this year is having to build back up and whatnot. So where do you get the sense there with Fleming's role kind of coming in? We're almost to opening day. Do you think he makes it? Do you see maybe like a younger vet? Like a Trevor Richards or Mazza or somebody like that for that multi-inning longer role? What's your sense?
I've put Fleming on my opening day roster projections here recently just because I do think there's going to be room in the bullpen and I do think you'll need innings. And he's such a fascinating guy to me that, like, let's say Chris Archer is stretched out to go 4 innings his first time through, or Michael Wach is going to be stretched out to probably go 5 or 6, but, you know, let's just say hypothetically one of those guys is only you're conserving innings to have them go 4 or 5 innings your first time out. Like, it'd be really interesting to see Josh Fleming coming in after that, because it's such a different look. And that's just so clearly the way that they build pitching staffs now, is providing different angles on guys. And I do think there is going to be a role for Trevor Richards. They've spoken really highly of him really since, you know, last year, since they acquired him, I suppose, at first, but since I came on the beat, I've heard positive things about the way that they
is Trevor this change Richards back? Is
going to. Apparently that's
it was hibernating last year.
Right. And if that pitch is there, then he's really interesting, and especially interesting coming off of, let's say, 3 innings of Rich Hill throwing fastball curveball from the left side. And then all of a sudden you get fastball changed up from the right side. And that's such a different look that, you know, it's going to be tough for lineups to adjust that. I think there's room for both, frankly. And especially if they're only going to go 12 position players, 14 pitchers on the opening day roster, There is room for more of those multi-inning guys, and Kevin Cash has made it pretty clear they want to prioritize multiple innings from relievers who aren't Nick Anderson, Diego Castillo, and Pete Fairbanks to start the season, because you're just going to need them. So to me, there's room for Fleming. And, you know, you look at just the way that he's come into camp and the way that he pitched last year, like the argument for putting him at the alt site is essentially that, yes, you will probably need a sixth starter at some point. So why not keep him on a starter's routine getting built up rather than pitching three or four innings at a time in the big leagues? But to me, that looks like a guy who can help you right now. So I'll be really curious to see what they do with him over the next 10 days.
Yeah, the delayed minor league season also complicates it too, because if you're going to keep a guy down to work in games, well, when are games happening?
Right, right. And how much better is he getting, and how much work is he getting facing his teammates every 5 days? And it's the same thing, honestly, a different subject, but prospect placement. You know, when you're talking about a AAA season that was supposed to begin a month earlier, like it would have made a lot more sense to put Wander Franco there to start the season because you would be getting game at-bats. But now that you're going to have the minor league season starting at the same time, like, doesn't it make a little more sense to have him at AA and Taylor Walls playing every day at shortstop and AAA, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it's very complicated. And in this regard, while farm directors and scouting directors don't envy me for having to rank these prospects, I don't envy them for having to make those decisions. So,
well, you've been so generous with your time. Before we go, is there anything I'm missing? Who do we not talk about? What questions are we not asking you right now?
Thank you. This was really comprehensive. And
I mean, yeah, we went through the list. It's a good list. It's a well-researched list. The quality shows in the writing from someone that is returning to covering the organization. I was personally blown away by the work that you put in. So congrats on working two full-time jobs.
And it was a lot of fun in spring training. Basically, just like you go and you wake up at 7:30 or whatever, and you do the Zooms, and you're at the ballpark, and you watch the games, and you go back, you take out dinner, and you sit in the hotel, and you write a lot of prospect reports, and you make a lot of phone calls, and you send a lot of emails and texts and everything like that. But honestly, it was super fun. You mentioned just coming back onto the beat. The organization's changed so much since I left. And when I left, you know, was when Friedman left and when Madden left and the cupboard was bare or whatever. And what they've done in the last couple of years to rebuild this organization into what is just clearly the envy of baseball is really amazing. And it's really fun to talk about. And I got that sense too from talking to other people outside the organization. They were, like I said earlier, they were so eager to talk about it. I got a lot of jokes that, like, how are you only going to rank 30 when they have 100 guys that you could talk about, you know? And I sent an initial, like, rough draft list to some evaluators of like 60 people. And they were like, how is this guy not in your top 30? And he's not even in the top 60 list. Like, it just speaks to the number, the quantity of quality that they have in the organization that made it a really fun challenge and a really neat way to kind of get to know the system coming back onto the beat for the first time. So I appreciate the kind words about the write-ups and everything. Had a ton of help from Jonathan Mayo, Jim Callis. I mentioned Mike Rosenbaum before, who did a lot of the legwork on previous Rays lists. And then just a ton of people throughout the industry, inside the organization especially. So a lot of fun. Fun to do. I don't know if we're going to do, if I'm doing the midseason re-rank, but we can
revisit this. It might be your job now.
Right, whether I like it or not. We can certainly revisit this conversation then, and hopefully you guys will still think that it's a good list by then.
Yeah, once 10 guys have graduated. All right.
Oh, Brent Honeywell. I didn't mention Brent Honeywell, where he falls on the list.
Oh, sure.
Take a full circle. That was the one question we didn't that was like the one guy on the 30 that we didn't talk about. So I had some people say that Brent Honeywell shouldn't be on the list because of his age and the question marks and the uncertainty, basically. It's just say, like, put him off the list. He's a separate thing entirely. And then I had some people saying, like, same guy, same upside, like, put him top 10. So we kind of split the difference and put him there at 20. He is one who I would buy stock in just purely as a person. Like, I think that that guy's going to get the most out of his ability as long as he's healthy. And I think that having him 20th could look really dumb by the end of this year. But that is about, again, long-term and factoring in injury concerns and everything like that. But that's one when I just looked at the list and I see Brent Honeywell 20th, and especially on a day like today where you see him go out there and you see him pitch and you're reminded of the upside of the guy, you're like, I don't know how I feel about that anymore. But, you know, that's just kind of where I was coming from with that one to bring it full circle here as far as the list and Brent Honeywell.
Absolutely. Well, it's the right way to cap off Honey Day.
That's right. Happy Honey Day to all who celebrate.
Now, if you don't mind me, I'm going to be Winnie the Pooh with my giant jar of honey, only wearing a red shirt. That's how I celebrate in this house.
Glad we're doing this on Zoom. Top half of the window only.
Well, thanks, Adam. Everyone read the list. It's good.
Thank you.
Thank you to Adam Berry for joining us, for going deep on the Rays prospect list. You can find all of Adam's writing at MLB.com and at RaysBaseball.com. You should read that top 30 prospect list. It is good. It is well-researched, and he knocked out of the ballpark. For Darby Robinson, my name is Daniel Russell. Thank you for listening. Read, rate, and subscribe. What? Isn't that? No. I'm sorry, Brett.
What? Yeah. Brett, if you want it, you can put it in. We're not going to tell you what to do with your lives.
No. Good luck editing this, man. Thank you.